Hey, listeners. Thanks for dropping in. I'm Christy.
And I'm Melissa. And this is Buried Motives, where we dig deep into the details of some of the most gruesome
dirtbag murderers. Hey, listeners.
Welcome back to Buried Motives.
We are very grateful that you've chosen to spend some time with us today.
We all have our podcast rotations that we love, and we are grateful for being in yours.
Absolutely. Even though Melissa and I spend hours creating our own podcast, we do take time to listen to others as well.
That's right. You know what I'm hooked on lately? Music City 911. Brandon is freaking awesome.
I love Brandon's voice, and he does such a good job. If you guys missed him, he was part of our Broken Hearts collaboration.
I just love listening to him. And the 911 calls add such an interesting aspect to the case. And it's a 911 call that I'm going to begin with today. A few minutes after noon on November 8th, 2002, the Stamford Police Department in Connecticut received a disturbing 911 call. The dispatcher listens as the frantic caller tells them, quote, "I think the guy is attacking my neighbor. I don't know her name, but she's my neighbor and she lives in 105. I saw a guy go into her apartment." The caller fumbled out the address and the line was unexpectedly disconnected. The dispatcher tried to reconnect the call, but was unsuccessful. The address given was 123 Harbor View. But that address just didn't jive with what the dispatcher knew about that area. There was no residential apartments in Harbor View. It was an area with a marina. It was a commercial area. Thinking quickly on her feet, this smart dispatcher tracked the location of the call to a payphone just outside a Duchess restaurant on Shippen Avenue in Stamford. The dispatcher called the nearby restaurant and spoke to the manager to see if they had seen anybody by a payphone, but they hadn't. More critical thinking led to the dispatcher identifying similar sounding areas close to the payphone, and she knew that 123 Harbor Drive did have a condo numbered 105. So that's where officers were sent to investigate.
That is so smart.
I am always amazed at what dispatchers can do under pressure.
Oh, they do not get enough credit. So if you're a dispatcher and you're listening, we appreciate you.
And the job you do. It's a hard one. When police arrived at the apartment, the door was unlocked and the scene of a horrific life and death struggle greeted the police as they entered. All over the entrance and foyer of the apartment, things were strewn about and knocked over. And there was blood everywhere. In the middle of the blood was 32-year-old Annalisa Raimondo's lifeless body. She had been viciously and repeatedly beaten. A dumbbell lay nearby covered in blood. Annalisa's face, neck, and chest had also been stabbed 9 times.
Oh.
One of the puncture wounds was so deep it reached the back of her lung.
Oh, that is a lot of force.
Mm-hmm.
That would have even compressed into her chest to get that far back.
It does create a disturbing visual image. Police had arrived as fast as they could, just after 12:30, thanks to the dispatcher's quick thinking. But it hadn't been fast enough. Annalisa's official cause of death was internal bleeding. She had lived through the entire attack, but had succumbed to her injuries alone, waiting for help to arrive.
Oh, I can't even imagine how terrifying that would be.
I'm sure it felt like an eternity as she waited for help. Police estimated, though, that it had been less than an hour since the attack, based on the coagulation state of the blood. Some of Annalisa's wounds still appeared to be bleeding when they arrived. It was estimated that she had died between 10:34 and 12:13 based on the last call that she had made to her mom and the 911 call being placed. She had left a message for her mom that morning just before her death, which I think would be so sad for her mom to listen to afterwards.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Police suspected a midday burglar might have been surprised to find Annalisa still home and then had become violent. But the crime scene didn't really support that theory. There were no signs of forced entry, and it didn't appear like areas like drawers and cupboards had been rummaged through. Crime scene techs painstakingly swabbed the vast amounts of bloodstains in the apartment, with the knowledge that often in such a chaotic fight, the attacker can become injured. If they had, then DNA might be able to identify them. Detective George Holt, a former Stamford police officer that worked the case, said that, quote, "In an edged weapon assault or homicide, it's very common for the hand to slip over the handle or over the hilt and go down on the blade and the perpetrator cuts themselves. It was an educated guess, but it would later pay off. based on the viciousness and the location of the majority of wounds that centralized around her face and chest, police started to suspect that the murderer must have been someone who had a personal connection with Annalisa. The last number dialed out of Annalisa's home phone had been to Nelson Sessler's office at Purdue Pharma at 11:57 a.m. Nelson, Annalisa's boyfriend, hadn't picked up the phone and no message had been left. Police became even more curious about Nelson when he showed up at Annalisa's apartment later that day. And while he seemed completely unaware of what was happening, he was eerily calm when police told him about his girlfriend's tragic death. When he had shown up at the house, it had been being actively searched, and he didn't ask why they were there or where Annalisa was.
Oh, that always raises some red flags. But we do have to remember that everyone processes grief and shock in a different way.
It's true. But when he did find out that she had died, there were no tears. And while he says he's willing to cooperate with the investigation, police are getting the opposite impression. One detective said it was like pulling teeth to get him to answer any question, and it raised huge red flags for them.
Oh, I bet. That totally reminds me of our Christmas episode with Michelle Anderson and Joseph McEnroe, when they pulled up at the parents' home and were asking if they could just go down and pass them to get to their own place, not even asking about if her parents were okay.
Right. And in that case, they were the dirtbags.
Yes.
There's a reason why police are suspicious of Nelson. He's not acting appropriately.
No.
So it's not a big surprise then when he's quickly brought in for questioning. But almost as quickly, he was discarded as a potential suspect when records from his work showed that he had been there between 9:37 and 5:10 that day.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So he's not our dirtbag.
He wasn't in this case. The company's security system had tracked his movements meticulously throughout the day, and there was no way that Nelson had left the office. During his interview with police, Nelson outlines his relationship with Annalisa, telling police that they had met in late 2000 at an after-work happy hour. Now, I have heard that pharmacy rep parties can be pretty wild. Not sure if the researchers' parties have the same reputation, but if Nelson's dating life is any indication, it sounds like they might have been.
There was more than just the drinks to make it a happy hour?
Yes. Over the next year, he dated Annalisa and a few other women from work, often meeting them at these work happy hours.
Okay.
Nelson said that they had all been just casual relationships that involved sex.
Well, I guess if everyone's consenting, then have your happy hour, Nelson.
It makes going to work a little bit easier every day, no?
I think it would make it more awkward. Can you imagine walking into your office and knowing you've seen half of those people naked?
That would be super awkward.
It would.
Nelson did say that as he and Annalise grew closer, though, he had chosen to be just with her, and the two were planning on getting married.
Okay.
In late 2002, Annalisa had just gotten a new job in New Jersey, so Nelson had been staying over at Annalise's house a lot, even though he still had his own place, just so that they could spend time together now that they weren't seeing each other every day at the office. That is why he had come to her home the day of the murder after work. He had stayed there the night before, and that morning he had left Annalisa to work from home. He tells police that he's a protective guy and that he was always telling Annalisa to be more aware of her surroundings, to not stand in front of her windows in case someone was watching her, and to always check to see if someone was following her. He had told her to be mindful of her safety, and he suggested to police that she might have been attacked by a peeping Tom. But when police asked if he could think of anyone that would want to hurt Annalisa, he couldn't think of anyone that didn't like her. He did give police the name of two of his former girlfriends who suffered from mental illnesses that he considered unstable. Not that he really thought they had anything to do with Annalisa's death, he was just trying to give the police something to go on.
Okay.
But he considered them unstable enough that you might want to check these people out.
Yeah, but I wonder how many people would describe their exes as unstable.
Oh, probably a lot. Police dutifully followed up on these leads, but nothing actually ever came of them. There was one lead that almost led to an arrest of a known burglar, but it turned out to be false. Police didn't have a lot to go on. There were no fingerprints found at the scene, and there were no matches to the DNA samples that had been collected. Police tried to track down the man that the caller had said attacked Annalisa, but they couldn't find anything. They even canvassed the neighborhood with the recording of the 911 caller to see if anyone could identify the voice, but no one could.
Hmm.
The case grew colder as the weeks passed, and probably would have continued had it not been for another mysterious connection to Annalise's boyfriend, Nelson.
Oh, he's not out of the thick of it yet.
No, not at all. Just 4 months later, he's found at another crime scene investigation.
What?
Yes.
Nelson, you might need to make better choices, son. What happened?
He likes to be in the action or get some action. On the 22nd of March in 2003, another 911 call was placed. This time, it was a medical resident of the Behavioral Health Center of Westchester Medical Center in Valhalla in New York. The call again was frantic, as he says that a man has been stabbed.
Was it Nelson? Did Nelson get stabbed?
Well, let me tell the story, Christy.
Okay.
The resident and other bystanders had watched as the man and a woman had tussled on the grass after getting out of a car. When the man broke free and started to run towards them, it was clear that he was injured. Blood soaked through the front of his shirt. While getting out of the car, the woman had stabbed him.
While he was running.
While he was trying to get out of the car, yeah.
Oh my goodness.
The woman tried to convince the resident to try and get the victim back into the car so that she could take him to the front of the hospital. But he had just watched this huge wrestling match go down and heard the man's cries for help as he was running away from her. So there's no way that he was ever going to help her get him back in the car.
No, that's taking a lamb to the slaughter.
Yeah. So instead, he calls 911. That's when the woman fled, when she found out that police were on their way. The witnesses were able to give the dispatcher a good description of the woman and the car that she had driven off in. But it wouldn't be all that hard to find her. Minutes later, she drove back into the parking lot and tried again to shove the injured man back into the car.
What? Mm-hmm. So she's saying, oh, I need to save this guy, but I'm not going to let you help him. I need to take him with me.
Yes, she's going to take him to the hospital.
But you're at the hospital.
On the back of the hospital.
Right.
Yeah. Why didn't she just drive him to the front of the hospital in the first place?
That's true. Or just let the resident take him. Most of us, when we go to the hospital in an emergency situation, as soon as you see medical staff, you want them to take over. You want them to help. If you're not a dirtbag.
Exactly. When she drove back into the parking lot, that's when police showed up and arrested her.
Good.
33-year-old Sheila Davalo was arrested on the spot for aggravated assault, the whole time claiming that the stabbing had been a work accident. It would be just the first of many lies that she would tell police during the interrogation that followed.
Did it happen during happy hour?
Well, it was a sort of happy hour that it happened in, but I don't think the man ended up thinking that afterwards.
No, not with a stab wound.
No, it wasn't actually until the man woke up from surgery that police get the full story about what had led to this second frantic 911 call.
So he lives.
He does live.
Oh, good.
Paul Christos, Sheila's husband, tells police that he and his wife, Sheila, had been home together on the Saturday afternoon and enjoying some personal time.
Okay.
So happy hour might have been involved.
It started out that way, it sounds like.
Yes.
So how does this involve Nelson?
We'll get there.
Okay.
So during this happy hour that this couple was having in their home on a Saturday afternoon.
Oh, an afternoon delight.
Yes. Sheila had suggested that they play a game in bed. According to his testimony given later in court, the game involved, quote, one person being handcuffed and blindfolded, while the other placed objects against the bound person's skin. The bound person was to guess the identity of the object. Sheila volunteered to be the first one blindfolded for the guessing game. She guessed various household items. Then it was Paul's turn. He was blindfolded and handcuffed to a chair. Paul guessed various common household items. For the final item, Sheila had sat on Paul's midsection and touched the item to his face.
Wait, I think I know this case.
You do?
Yes! Okay, that visual that you just painted, I have heard this case before because that stuck with me. I did not realize that that was this case that you're telling.
It is. This bedroom scene is quite memorable.
Oh yeah, it's stuck in my memory, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. This is a wild one.
It is. Because when Sheila sat on Paul's lap, she touched what he thought was a candle to his face. He was wrong. The item was a paring knife that Sheila had retrieved from their kitchen.
Oh.
She thrust the knife into his chest once and then a second time. Paul, not knowing what had happened, was stunned and heard Sheila say, quote, I think I hurt you. You're bleeding. Still blindfolded and handcuffed, Paul asked what had happened as pain started to spread.
Oh, I cannot even imagine. And what a betrayal of trust.
Yes. I think the whole incident would have been that much worse because he was blindfolded.
And naked in a chair.
Yes.
Totally vulnerable.
Sheila told him that, quote, something fell on you. I think the candle hurts you. Paul asked his wife to remove the blindfold, and she did. But when he asked her to remove the handcuffs, she stated that she couldn't find the key. Paul pleads with her to help him break the chair that the handcuffs are attached to. He asks her to call 911, and he thought she did shortly before 5 p.m. that day. But when a significant amount of time had passed and no ambulance arrived, he asked her to call 911 again and said he wanted to talk to the dispatcher himself. His wife replied that the dispatcher didn't want to talk to him and wanted him to lay down on the floor.
Yeah, not likely.
Mm-hmm. Eventually, Paul begs his wife to take him to the nearby hospital, and she agrees. Paul distinctively remembers how slow Sheila drove that day, and when they arrived at the hospital, instead of pulling up to the emergency doors, she parked in the rear of the hospital.
Oh.
Around 5:30, Sheila got out of the car and came around to Paul's side. While pretending to help him out of the car, she stabbed him a third time, this time very deeply. Somehow he managed to battle away from her, and that's when the bystanders from the medical center had seen the fight over the knife. After police learned this whole story, Sheila's charges were upgraded from aggravated assault to attempted murder, first-degree assault, and criminal possession of a weapon, and was placed in the Westchester County Jail. That same night of the attack, Nelson again comes to his girlfriend's apartment and is greeted by police who tell him that it's an active crime scene investigation.
So him and Sheila are hooking up.
Yes. Nelson tells police that his girlfriend, Sheila, had called him earlier that day around 5 p.m. and invited him over to her Pleasantville apartment for dinner that night. He had no idea that there was a husband. He is flabbergasted. What husband, he asked the police. Sheila had told him that she was divorced.
Oh my goodness. And wait, you said she called him at 5 o'clock when she had told her husband that she was calling 911.
Yes.
Dirty dog.
Crazy, right?
So she was calling Nelson instead of the ambulance.
Yes. And she was just hoping that her husband was going to bleed out.
What a dirtbag.
And then it was just taking so long, and she had to now keep up the ruse because he could tell a story. So she decides to take him to the hospital and then stabs him again.
Who can actually stab their husband and then call their boyfriend to make dinner plans when he's not even gone yet?
It is really cold. But Nelson isn't quite off the hook yet with the police. He's brought in again the next day for questioning, and he tells police that he and Sheila had previously met in early 2001 at a work party and had gotten acquainted.
During happy hour.
Yep. That meeting had evolved into a fling by the summer. He tells police when he and another woman, Annalisa, had started to get serious, Nelson said that he had stopped the sexual relationship with Sheila. But they had rekindled their casual affair after Annalisa had died unexpectedly.
But he didn't mention that she had been murdered.
Not at this point, he doesn't.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. He told police Sheila had comforted him and been a good friend to him. Nelson said that he and Sheila began to have a sexual relationship in January of 2003 when she had invited him on a group ski trip. Interestingly, everyone else that was supposed to go on that trip didn't show up.
Including her husband.
Well, I don't think her husband was ever invited.
You know, I'm just kidding. No, she didn't invite anybody. She just wanted to get him alone.
Exactly. He said that he had stayed over at her apartment several times before and after Annalisa's death, and never once got the impression that she was ever married. He knew that she was a busy person, so they weren't together all the time. He believed that she was busy because she helped take care of her mentally ill brother, and that she was an athletic person that played volleyball frequently. He had been to her house on multiple occasions and had even slept over, and Nelson claimed that there was never any sign that Sheila lived with anyone, let alone a husband.
So wild.
It is. How she takes care of this is so crazy.
I've never heard anything like it.
Police were suspicious of Nelson's story, and I honestly think I would be too.
Oh, absolutely we would be.
Yeah. Who believes somebody that they can't see any evidence of a husband or somebody else living with somebody?
For sure. Plus, his previous girlfriend was murdered, so it's not looking good for Nelson.
Well, they haven't quite connected all of that yet. At this point yet, they don't even realize that this is the second time he just happened to show up at a crime scene.
Oh, okay.
They don't have all the details of Annalisa's death yet. When Westchester police check out Nelson's story, that's when they made the connection that Sheila had called him when she was pretending to call 911.
I still can't believe that.
Yeah. They dig into Nelson's story a little bit deeper. They head off to his house in Stamford to ask him some questions. A friendly neighbor greets them and assumes that they're there investigating the murder of Nelson's girlfriend. Not a fact that Nelson had shared with them. Having a precious girlfriend die is a lot different than having one murdered.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So they head over to the Stamford police station to get all the details on that murder. They compare notes, and the officer that has just come from interviewing Sheila for the past 12 hours has to hear the 911 call involved in Annalisa's death. That officer is sure the caller is Sheila. At the same time that police are connecting these two cases, Nelson claims that he too was beginning to piece things together. And he says that he began to think, quote, if she could have stabbed a husband I didn't know she had, she certainly could have stabbed Annalisa. It all started to come together.
Oh, man.
That would be a scary realization.
It would.
Nelson tells Stamford police his suspicions, and he agrees to continue visiting Sheila in jail while wearing a wire and recording phone calls and conversations that he has with her. Neither police department is completely ready to write Nelson off as a suspect, especially since he had never been completely honest about being in a relationship with Sheila when he was interviewed initially about Annalisa's death. She wasn't one of the ex-girlfriends that he had mentioned previously.
Okay. But you can see why you wouldn't list all of your escapades.
Well, at that time, he didn't really believe that Sheila had ever taken their relationship seriously and that she didn't seem that unstable to him. So he had wanted to actually protect his friend from the intimidating interrogation by the police. Okay. So he purposely hadn't brought her up because he didn't think she was unstable.
That's why you just let the police know, because you just never know.
Yeah. Nelson still seemed cagey, though, with his answers about his relationship with Sheila. It took a lot to get Nelson to admit that he had originally been seeing both women at the same time. He had made up all of these kind of half-truths, saying that Annalisa and Sheila had worked together and that they were all just friends that would occasionally go out for drinks, and that he just helped Sheila walk her two dogs on occasion. Which definitely raised an eyebrow from the detective, who insisted that no man would drive from Connecticut to New York to walk dogs without getting laid.
Well, at least he wouldn't, obviously.
He was not a good Samaritan that would do that. It was hard for police to believe that Nelson had nothing to do with the case, that he didn't have any idea that Sheila was married, or that she was obsessed with him. But Nelson's unusual affair was corroborated by Paul. Recovering from the attempt on his life, Paul now has lots to say about his supposedly loving wife.
Oh, man. Poor Paul. Mm-hmm. Well, and Nelson.
They were just all wrapped up in Sheila's lies. Sheila Davalo, an Iranian-American, was born on May 11, 1969, in Charlottesville, Virginia. When she was very young, her parents decided to move back to their home country of Iran. In Iran, things were less than ideal for her family. Just before she turned 10, the Iranian Revolution began. An upheaval in the country was unimaginable. She lived in a country filled with fighting to the death over political and religious views. It was a nightmarish childhood, witnessing continual violence with literal bombs being dropped in her backyard.
Oh my goodness.
When she turned 17, her family again returned to the U.S., taking up residence in the New York suburb of Yorkton Heights. Both of her parents found jobs working in healthcare, and after graduating from the University of Stony Brook with a degree in biochemistry, Sheila decided to use her considerable intelligence towards a career in pharmaceuticals. It was while she was at New York Medical College that she had met Paul in 1994. The two dated for over a year before he learned that Sheila was already married.
What?
Yes.
Ooh, I forgot this part.
At 19, she had been married to Farhad Masav, a family friend, in an arranged marriage. According to Sheila, while the two got along, she was never truly happy in the relationship. She didn't feel the need to be honest with Paul because she planned on divorcing Farhad. When Farhad found out about the affair, he didn't act like most husbands would. Although, that kind of happened in my last case as well, so maybe it happens more than you think. He calls up Paul and arranges to meet him to explain a few things over coffee. He tells Paul that Sheila is all about the dramatics and can be unstable, calling her total chaos. Not that he didn't concede that she could be charming at times, especially when you first met her. Sheila was described by many as a woman that got what she wanted and didn't care about how she went about getting it. By charm, manipulation, or threats, she would make sure she got what she wanted.
This is crazy to me that instead of being angry about the whole situation, he's like, hey, bro, I need to let you know a few things. I have to look out for you. If you're going to take my wife, this is what you need to know.
That's exactly what the meeting sounded like. Like he was pretty much feeling guilty about passing her on and wanted to make sure that Paul knew what he was getting into.
That is wild. Mm-hmm. I wonder how many husbands would react that way.
Please take her off my hands. Right? I feel guilty about you doing this, so let me give you the dirt.
Thanks for doing me a solid, man.
Yeah. A shocked Paul then went back to Sheila for her side of the story. What a nice guy, I thought. I mean, after all this, he's like, okay, I'll let you tell your side.
Giving her the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm. Of course, she laid it on pretty thick about how bad the relationship was for her and how she had never truly been happy in the forced arrangement. Sheila was a convincing person, and she and Paul ended up staying together after her divorce from Farid went through uncontested. Sheila and Paul were married in 2000 and moved to Pleasantville, New York, the following year. Located just north of New York City in a suburb of Westchester County, it was a convenient commuting distance for both of their jobs. Paul worked at Cornell University at its New York City campus, while Sheila had landed a job as a pharmaceutical scientist at Purdue Pharma, located in Stamford, Connecticut. It was there that Sheila would meet Nelson in 2001, when he started at the same company as a scientist. It was also where Annalisa worked as an associate director. Paul never suspected the affair. While the honeymoon phase of their passion had fizzled out, Paul and Sheila were still close friends and shared their daily lives together. When police came to question him after the attack, just like Nelson, Paul says he had no idea that there was another man in his wife's life. In hindsight, though, he was seeing his wife's actions in a new light. And he's able to shed a little bit more light on the lies that Sheila told to get away with the affair.
What a horrific realization.
It's just one thing on top of another piled on Paul. First, yeah. She stabs him, then he learns she was having an affair.
Yeah, you would be questioning your entire relationship.
Mm-hmm. During the previous 2 years, Sheila had occasionally had her brother, Shaheem, who suffered from schizophrenia, come to visit her. She told Paul that her brother was unaware that she was married, and she was fearful that that fact might upset her brother. So she asked her husband not only to spend the night away from his own home, but insisted that any trace of him be removed so that her brother would not suspect that she was married and become upset.
This is so wild to me that this happened.
In hindsight, it seems so obvious.
Well, I don't know about obvious, but just so unreasonable. Can you imagine being asked to take every single thing that you own in your home and go away just for a night?
It just seems crazy.
Yeah. I'd be like, I'll rent you a hotel to go with your brother. Like, why does he have to come here?
But Paul did agree to it because it seemed important to Sheila.
Yeah. And he loved her and he wanted to be kind to his wife.
That's right. And he gets the raw end of the stick.
Yeah.
So he helped her remove his clothes and his toiletries from the house, even pictures that he appeared in. Then he would dutifully go and stay at his parents' or another friend's house for the night or the weekend, whenever her brother came to visit.
Wow.
This explains why Nelson had believed that she was divorced. That's how good Paul was at doing something to please his dirtbag of a wife.
That's so sad.
Mm-hmm. Around the same time that Nelson had started to get serious with Annalisa, and cooling it with Sheila, unknown to Paul, Paul started to hear about the love triangle between the three co-workers at Sheila's work.
Oh, that's right.
Sheila would tell Paul all about her friend Melissa, who had found out her boyfriend Jack was also seeing another woman, Annalisa.
She couldn't even come up with a new name.
Nope. Sheila would go into great detail explaining the saga to Paul, even the intimate details of the sex that was happening in the affair.
No.
She would tell him that she just didn't know what to tell her friend Melissa, who was so sad and depressed by this betrayal. She would talk to him about it almost every day, going on and on about Melissa and Jack's relationship. Sheila told Paul that Melissa was upset when Jack rebuffed her sexual advances and told him crazy stories about how Melissa had at one point discovered Jack's travel plans and had flown to Jack's destination. She then conveniently ran into him at the airport as he was boarding the plane home and sat next to him for the return flight. Sheila would ask Paul for advice on behalf of Melissa with questions such as, why would Jack be in a relationship with two women and why would Jack cheat?
Oh, good questions to ask yourself, Sheila.
Yeah. Paul, when he heard these stories, listened like a good husband and said he humored Sheila with her theorizing because he felt like it was just some office drama.
How sickening for Paul to realize later that his wife was telling him intimate details about herself and her lover.
About their sex life.
Yes. And then asking for advice I wonder if Sheila was getting off from that.
Oh, I am sure she was. But Paul just felt like all this drama allowed Sheila to live vicariously through another person's life, because their own, he said, was a little bit boring. He said by this point in their relationship, they had become more like roommates than a married couple. And that's how he explained her over-interest in this triangle that was happening at work. As time went on, Sheila got more and more invested in Melissa's problems. She asked Paul to borrow his night vision goggles because she wanted to go on a stakeout with Melissa to spy on Jack.
Oh.
She also purchased a lockpick set for her friend, although she was the one to practice with it on the front door of their Pleasantville condominium unit. At one point, she asked to borrow Paul's eavesdropping device and help Melissa plant it in Jack's office so they could listen to his conversations.
Oh, and all the while, Paul has no idea that he's helping his wife to spy on her boyfriend.
That's right. But I do have to question, why the heck does Paul have all of these things?
That's true, actually, because he's a researcher.
Yeah, I never found out. It is a question I still have. When Paul got sick of hearing about the love triangle, Sheila started to seek advice from other friends. Her friends would say that almost every time they spoke, Sheila would ask her questions such as, quote, whether she thought Jack would break up with Annalisa and date Melissa. Quite a few times, Sheila asked if Melissa should confront Annalisa to, quote, let her know that she, Melissa, was also seeing Jack. When her friends told her it probably wasn't a good idea, Sheila didn't seem overly pleased with this advice. And her friends got the impression that Sheila wanted them to say that Melissa should confront Annalisa.
Because that's what she was wanting to do.
Mm-hmm. One morning, Sheila came to Paul and told him that she and Melissa were outside of Annalisa's apartment and asked him if Melissa should confront Annalisa. Not grasping the whole story, Paul told Sheila that Annalisa had a right to know her boyfriend was cheating on her. He didn't know that in the real twisted love story that Melissa was his wife, and that Jack was Nelson. He didn't know that his wife had become utterly obsessed with another man and his new girlfriend. She was reading Nelson's work emails and listening to his voicemails, following him around on planes. She was truly obsessed, to the point that Sheila had actually reached out for psychiatric help herself. On November 13th, Paul, as a part of his own work, had a meeting with some representatives at Pharmacia, the new company in New Jersey that Annalisa had recently begun to work at after leaving Purdue Pharma for unknown reasons. And I think perhaps those reasons were she might have felt like she was being stalked there.
Aww.
Because she was.
Yeah.
During that meeting, Paul learned that one of the new employees at the drug company had recently been murdered. While he didn't learn the victim's name at the time, Paul did say that he did have an odd thought pop into his mind that maybe Melissa had done something to Annalisa.
Oh my goodness, not knowing that that's his wife.
No, but it was such a disturbing thought and nagged at him so much that he brought it up with Sheila later, asking if Annalisa was okay. Sheila didn't act shocked at all by his newfound interest in the love triangle, not even when he asked her point blank if Melissa had done something to Annalisa. She just simply said Annalisa was fine. Later, Sheila would tie up the loose ends of her imaginary love triangle at work by telling Paul that Jack had broken up with Annalisa and that Jack and Melissa were now back together exclusively. She told other friends the same story, adding the detail that Annalisa had moved away to New Jersey and gotten a job there. That was all around the same time that Sheila's brother started making more frequent trips to see his sister.
Oh, what a dirtbag.
Such a dirtbag. And I think it's pretty easy in hindsight to question why Paul was so gullible about the whole affair and the Annalisa stalking and the murder. But really, he was a husband that loved his wife. And so he didn't think poorly of her at all. He couldn't imagine that she would do these things. He was blind to all of the signs until it was too late.
Yes. And if she was able to hide the fact that she lived with a man for years when Nelson would come to her apartment, how good was she at hiding the fact that she was stepping out on him?
Right. She's a master of duplicity. By the beginning part of 2003, the frequency of Sheila's brother's visits were starting to grate on Paul. So he had it out with her and he tells her that it's time her brother learns that she has a husband.
Yeah.
This ultimatum and the fact that Paul had started to question Annalisa's safety, I feel, were the motivating factors that led Sheila to suggest that she and Paul play a guessing game on that March 22nd afternoon. It was the same theory that the prosecution team had as well.
What a coward. Why not just leave your husband?
She should have just left. But instead, she chose to stab him. In February of 2004, Sheila faced a judge-only trial over the attempted murder case. Of course, she pled not guilty and tried to lie over and over again. When she could no longer deny that she had actually stabbed her husband, she told the judge that it wasn't because of the affair that she had done it, but that it was because she didn't want to shame her family by getting a divorce.
Oh, a second divorce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's still all about your pride.
It wasn't about the divorce at all. If she was actually concerned about dishonoring her family, then maybe she would have been a little bit more concerned about actually murdering someone.
Or staying faithful to her spouse.
Right. But that wasn't the reason for any of it. And it just showed Sheila's personality of trying to manipulate the facts and the people around her into thinking that she was the victim in order to avoid responsibility for her actions.
Right.
Her manipulative ways were very effective on Paul, who did testify that she had stabbed him, but at many times in his testimony almost defended and made excuses for Sheila, saying that she had never been violent in the past. And so almost giving her an out, like this was just a one-time off-the-rocker thing.
Oh, he's way too good for her. Oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm. He was deeply confused about the woman that he had loved and who was now a murder suspect. He had divorced her, but he was still susceptible to her charms. But at the same time, it's not like he could have said, well, I don't believe she could do that because she had tried to kill him.
Yeah.
So he had the truth glaringly in front of him, and yet he still was having a hard time believing it.
Oh, I'm sure you would have this ginormous inner turmoil.
It would have been so hard for him. After being found guilty on February 19th, Paul even made statements at the sentencing in April on behalf of Sheila, calling for a lesser sentence and mental help instead of punishment.
Wow.
He said he was still unsure about what her intentions had been when she stabbed him.
What?
Yes. The judge, though, had watched Sheila's manipulation and pathological lying play out right before him, and he wasn't fooled. Judge Thomas Dickerson told Sheila that she had tried to kill her husband, waited for him to die, and had lied over and over again, and accused her of being a dangerous threat to society. Sheila was sentenced to the maximum of 25 years in state prison without the possibility of parole, which is the toughest sentence allowed in New York state law for this offense.
Wow.
As Sheila served the sentence for her attempted murder charges in New York Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women, investigators were still gathering evidence to charge her with Annalise's murder. Investigators from both police departments started swapping stories. And over the next 3 years, investigators built a solid case against her. They took their time investigating every lead, crossing their T's and dotting their I's. Because after all, she really wasn't going anywhere.
No, they had the luxury of getting it completely right.
Mm-hmm. Digital comparisons of the 911 audio in Annalise's murder were compared to Sheila's voice and returned a positive result. They secured a warrant to test her DNA against the blood that was found at the bottom of the bathroom faucet handle in Annalise's apartment. It was a 1 in 8.5 million match. The search warrant for her condo found photographs and memorabilia of her and Nelson's relationship and night vision goggles that she had used to spy on Annalisa. Police learned through CCTV and card swipe access that at 10:53 a.m. on the morning that Annalisa was murdered, Sheila left work at Purdue Pharma and didn't re-enter until 1:53 p.m. Her cell phone tracking points show her in the vicinity of Annalisa's condo. Police also learned that when she left for work that day around 4 p.m., she left Nelson a voicemail on his phone, telling him to have a good weekend.
Oh,
she's just cruel.
She's horrible.
Mm-hmm. They also talked to Paul and numerous friends that say that after Annalisa's death, Sheila started to ask unusual questions about fingerprinting and evidence collection, and asking around to see if the company had everybody's DNA on file. Police also learned from Paul that in November, although he couldn't remember the exact date, Sheila had come home with a very nasty cut across her thumb. She had told them that she had cut it while opening a can of dog food for their two dogs, but she had come home from work with the cut. All very suspicious things in hindsight. Police also took Nelson up on his offer to help out with the investigation and became privy to letters that Sheila sent him from jail and conversations that they still continued to have. In one conversation, Nelson pressed Sheila on secrets she had kept from him, such as her husband and the events on November 8, 2002. He pressed her saying, quote, "It would help me a lot to tell me what happened in the fall." Sheila responded, quote, "That would make my life a lot more difficult."
Oh.
Police took their time building the solid case of evidence against her, but it was no secret that Sheila was their prime suspect. Shortly after the attempted murder conviction, Annalisa's father, Dr. Rinaldo Raimondo, publicly stated, how he believed that Sheila was his daughter's killer. Sheila Davalow was finally charged with Annalisa Raimondo's murder on November 6, 2007, almost 5 years to the day of the murder. It was still a while before the trial could actually happen because of several pretrial rulings that had to be made over allowing Paul's testimony against his former wife. Ultimately, it was ruled that the conversations about the fabled love triangle could be used as evidence because the statements were not made with the intention of infection, confidence, loyalty, or for the integrity of Paul and Sheila's marriage relationship.
Yeah, to Paul, it was gossip.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't being made to make their relationship better.
Right.
She was telling him about her affair with another man. The ruling judge pointed out that the conversations were, in fact, the exact opposite and could only be considered good for the couple's relationship if there was some other parallel universe that he wasn't aware of.
I love that. Well put.
He was so cheeky about it. When the trial finally got started in 2012, Sheila chose to represent herself, presenting the case that she was emotionally unstable due to PTSD from her time in Iran and from her diagnosis of bipolar disorder, but she maintained that she was not a murderer. It was something that she just would not be capable of.
It always floors me when someone wants to represent themselves. Don't do it.
Worst advice ever. But I thought this particular defense was even more ironic because here she was telling people that she just wasn't capable of murder, but she had to be extradited to Connecticut from Bedford Hills Prison, where she was already serving a sentence for attempted murder.
Yes. If she had it her way, Paul would have died that day.
Mm-hmm. But that was her defense, and she was sticking to it. She claimed that she had been the victim of a cover-up and tainted evidence, and that's why the police were harassing her with another murder charge. It was all a big cover-up.
Oh, she's just a big victim.
She said that there was no way that, as a much smaller woman, that she could have surprised and overthrew Annalisa, who was much taller than she was. And she took the opportunity to really ham it up when Paul took the stand. While asking to see his injuries, she started to cry and became so emotional, a recess had to be called. Afterwards, she apologized for her emotional outbursts, cracking jokes, and then went on to establish with Paul that she had become depressed in November of 2002, unable to sleep or complete simple tasks. The prosecution was quick to jump on that line of questioning and pointed out that this is when Annalisa was murdered. It was a rookie mistake, but Sheila thought that she was just so smart.
Oh.
And the kicker for Sheila's behavior? She told the jurors that she had chosen to represent herself so that they could get to know her and hear her voice, so that they could tell for themselves that it was not her voice on the 911 tape. That way, they didn't have to rely on faulty digital analysis.
Where that probably totally backfired, and they got to know her voice to be able to recognize it.
Yeah. The jury, of course, did not buy any of it. Instead, they believed the prosecution's story of the obsessed love and jealousy and found her guilty of first-degree murder on February 12, 2012, and she was later sentenced to 50 years at the age of 42. That sentence, though, won't begin until she completes her sentence in New York.
Oh, so that's 75 years in total?
Yes. Her earliest possible release date is 2079. She'll be 110.
Wow.
During this sentencing, the judge admonished Sheila to honor Annalisa's memory by finding a way to contribute to those that she would encounter while incarcerated, saying that, quote, "I think the victim here would ask you to do that. She was a good soul. She was a charitable person." After the trial, Annalisa's parents said of their daughter that she was a highly accomplished and successful young woman that graduated from Harvard, that she, quote, was a perfect daughter and an excellent human being. Annalisa was stunningly beautiful, kind and bubbly, and was taken too soon, all because of the jealous actions of an obsessed dirtbag. In prison, Sheila has maintained her innocence and has claimed that her cell phone records will show that she wasn't in Connecticut at all at the time of the murder. She maintains that that was all just a cover-up by police. She tries to say that stabbing her husband three different times was an accident and that she was mentally unstable during that time in her life. In 2017, Piers Morgan met with Sheila for an interview. In it, she tries to make a case for her innocence by saying that she had nothing to do with Annalisa's murder and that had she really wanted to kill her husband, she wouldn't have used a paring knife.
Oh,
she says, quote, "There are much bigger knives available to her in the kitchen."
The audacity.
Yeah, as if that argument was going to clear her of the charges.
Right.
She would make that same argument again when she appeared on Snapped 2 years later. This obsessed and self-absorbed dirtbag believes that pointing this out would help others see that she wasn't crazy enough to try and kill her husband after killing her lover's girlfriend. It doesn't work. She ends up coming across as a pathetic liar, trying to grasp for attention, spinning circular arguments on deaf ears.
Yeah, I'm smelling hogwash, for sure.
At the end of the interview, Piers Morgan tells her that, quote, "The saddest thing for me is your apparent self-delusion. You've convinced yourself that you did not do it." Afterwards, he shared an impression of Sheila saying, quote, "She's an astonishingly selfish, greedy, obsessive, devious, and dishonest lunatic."
Tell us how you really feel.
Yeah, really. But I don't think I could have said it any better for the dirtbag, the calculating and manipulative pathological liar, Sheila Davalow.
Wow. I definitely learned some new things about that case.
I love revisiting a case after you haven't heard it for a while.
Yeah.
And this is a wild one to listen to.
It really is.
And next week, I'm sure you'll have another wild one for us, Christy.
Oh, I absolutely do. There's no shortage of dirtbags, that's for sure. But until then,
see ya.
Bye.
We are recording for realsies this time, Christy.
Oh, that's right. I have a...
Oh, she just said something in her mouth.
Okay, I'll put that one down. I'll have that one later.
I'll get rid of my headphones.
Okay. Drinky drink. I'll drink your poo.
Just as we say, we're ready to start testing.
Say it again. It sounded a little funky.
I've only said it 7 times, Christy.
How I know, but well, now funky? That you added buried bonus in there, it just sounded choppy. They're probably removing snow.
Yes, it is April. And we still have snow plows running the streets.
It's true. My mom listens to this. You have to take that part out. I'm enjoying hearing it again, actually, because it's such a crazy one.
Paul says he had no idea that there was another wang. There's another wang in this woman's life.
Another wang? Is that what the kids call it now?
That's right. There was another wang in his wife's life. Then maybe she would have been a little bit more concerned about mortar. About murdering.
She tried calling me. I just don't want it to show up on the thing. Yeah. She has sent me like so many texts. She's like, "Where are you? Where are you?" Every few seconds, I just like 14 messages from her. I'm telling her you're going in the bloopers.
Okay. Where was I at?
Hey, we're live, pal, and we'd love for you to come check out our podcast, Tales from the Estate. Each week, we talk about our top 5 favorite somethings. My beautiful wife, Caitlin, likes to share all sorts of random facts.
Yeah, did you know that cows have accents?
We did now. But we also review all sorts of snacks and other great things. And so if you love everything random, I think you'd enjoy Tales from the Estate. So come check us out.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Hi, this is Candace Sampson, the voice behind What She Said. My show is your destination for stories that not only entertain, but also educate and empower. Every week, I spotlight strong female voices from across Canada, women who are changing the narrative and driving change. Don't miss out on these inspiring episodes. Subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and Amazon Music, or head over to whatshesaidtalk.com.
What She Said can also be heard on blasttheradio.com, Mondays at 5 p.m. and Wednesdays at 7 p.m. That's blasttheradio.com.
It's time to dive into the stories that truly matter.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.